Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's been 1 week since Donald Trump was elected to be the 45th president of the United States, and the days since have been a whirlwind for Trump's inner circle as the process to select cabinet members and other critical staff picks up speed. Positions being watched closely include Secretary of State and Defense Secretary, and also that of National Security Advisor, technically not a member of the president's cabinet, but a key pick nonetheless, considering Mr. Trump's lack of experience in foreign policy. On January 20th of next year, the Trump administration inherits numerous global conflicts, including the battle against ISIS, the conflict in Syria, a complicated relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin. There's also the Iran nuclear pact and the looming threat posed by North Korea. And we'll take some time to look at how Donald Trump's victory last week has emboldened nationalist movements in Europe. So lots to talk about. And as always, lines are open. If you'd like to join the conversation, here is the number, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Joining us this hour, Dominic Tierney, Associate Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College. He is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Welcome back, Dominic.
Good morning.
And Ron Granieri is Director of Research at the Lauder Institute and Executive Director of the FBRI Center for the Study of America and the West. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So let's begin with the latest news. President-elect Trump had a telephone conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Monday. And the two appear to admire each other, despite not having met or spoken previously. According to the Kremlin, at least this is something that I saw in the Times, they agreed on, quote, the absolutely unsatisfactory state of bilateral relations and agreed to try to normalize relations and to try to cooperate on a broad range of ideas. Initial thoughts here. Ron?
Well, what is definitely true is that Trump has demonstrated an affection for strong leaders or people he considers to be strong leaders. Some people see that as rather worrying. And Vladimir Putin has been the subject of a lot of his positive statements. And this might say something about Trump's individual psychology, but it also reflects a common feeling on the American right that's been growing over the past couple of years, which is a respect for, almost an affection for Vladimir Putin as somebody who has stood against liberalism. And this, I think, is one of the really interesting developments in American politics, that the rejection of certain developments in multiculturalism, the developments of what people, some people in the U.S. on the right see as the fragmentation of society, that they've taken a shine to the authoritarian image of Vladimir Putin. And Trump has taken that. And there are serious foreign policy analysts who are arguing, who consider themselves to be realists with a capital R, who think that the United States and Russia should be, as two great powers, should essentially be dividing up spheres of influence rather than allowing smaller states to create conflict. Yeah. And so that sort of that mixture of attitudes has fed Donald Trump's affair or bromance with Vladimir Putin.
Bromance. Dominic Tierney, he was a goal to build a, quote, a collaborative dialogue based in part on, quote, non-interference in the other's internal affairs. Do we read Crimea here?
Possibly, depending on whether Crimea is considered part of Russia or part of Ukraine. So Putin has been in charge of Russia 15 years or so in different roles. And the United States has had a very difficult relationship overall. Obama, of course, famously tried the reset button. There was that famous picture with literally a button. Still, the Obama administration was quite cautious. And traditionally, Republicans have been very worried about Russia. People like John McCain, you know, have seen Putin as a KGB kind of operative and have seen Russia as being guilty of systematic aggression in Georgia. And then in Ukraine, and then in Syria. What Trump is putting forward here is really a potentially a dramatic new direction in American foreign policy. And I think it does reflect in part his comfort with strong leaders. He's also talked favorably about strong leaders in China, for example. And it also reflects wariness of getting involved in complex civil wars. Why can't we just deal with the sort of the devil we know? Mm-hmm. And so Crimea and Ukraine is a classic example of this. And it does seem that Trump is going to be willing to accept Russian annexation of the Korea of Crimea, unless at least de facto, even if it's not de jure. And this is a dramatic shift because this was is out and out territorial aggrandizement, the kind of thing that we thought had sort of been left back in the 1940s, and yet here we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yet, ironically, and this is from whatever it's worth, sources ostensibly close to Trump say, John Bolton, the former mm-hmm. U.S. ambassador to the U.N., is Mr. Trump's top choice for Secretary of State. Now, that has not been confirmed. Mm-hmm. But if this is the case, John Bolton is no fan of Vladimir Putin.
No, he's not. And I think this is where we have to disentangle or to at least recognize the variety of isms that drive Trumpism. Some people want to say that it's isolationism, but I don't think that's really quite accurate. I think there is, however, a big whiff of unilateralism, right? The idea that alliances just get in the way, that they tie the United States down, they keep us from doing what we want to do. And while John Bolton is certainly much more critical of Russia, John Bolton is even more critical of America's traditional allies, which puts him very much in line with Trump's unilateralist approach. And so this is where arguments that the United States doesn't need to be the global cop, right? This has been appeals to a lot of people. But I think that that Trump has never made quite clear when he talks about the United States being more free, putting American interests first. This doesn't necessarily mean the United States withdrawing from the world. It does, however, mean that the United States wants to be able to do what it wants when it wants. And John Bolton, for better or for worse, I think reflects that attitude very clearly.
If he does end up being Donald Trump's choice, do you think he gets past Senate Democrats and moderate Republicans? Might be a bit of a fight there.
Well, I think there would be a fight. I think most likely he would get through. You know, if Donald Trump is looking to find senior advisors who share all of his beliefs about the world, he's going to struggle mm-hmm. because they simply don't exist among the senior figures in the Republican Party. The bench is thin from whom he can select, particularly when Trump believes so strongly in loyalty. And so many GOP foreign policy officials explicitly rejected him, often with very extreme language mm-hmm. during the course of the campaign. And so if you look at other candidates like Senator Corker and other people, they're often very tough on Russia. And so there's going to be these differences by necessity. And I think that he will be able to get that nomination if it was Bolton through the Democratic Senate, or at least enough Democratic senators will go along with it. I think early on, the Democrats are not going to sort of declare war on Trump.
And by the way, just this note, tomorrow, Marty Moskowain is going to go in depth into Russia's role in the election of Donald Trump. Oh. So I just want to give our listeners a heads up for that. Be sure to tune in for that. Let's turn to Iraq for a moment. Special Forces still engaged in the painstaking fight to gain ground in Mosul. Donald Trump has said attacks against ISIS must remain secret. Defense Secretary Ash Carter says it's important to tell ISIS that the intent is to destroy the group. How quickly does the Trump administration plan take shape here, if it takes shape, you know, in the form of what he was saying on the campaign trail? At all, Ron?
Well, I think that Trump's emphasis on we have to maintain the element of surprise was reflected the depth of his thinking about foreign policy. In other words, I think that that's a very knee-jerk reaction, because certainly on a military operation like in Mosul, you're not going to be able to keep that a secret for very long. And indeed, this is where needing to appreciate the diplomatic importance of talking to your allies and working with your allies. And because we are not providing the ground forces in Mosul, obviously we have to keep our allies happy. So keeping secrets makes no sense. I think that one of the interesting things is, you know, we got 2 months until Donald Trump becomes president, and a lot can happen in Mosul in 2 months. I wonder to the extent to which the Trump administration might be waiting to see and hope that some of the new facts will be created on the ground. When we talk about Syria, this, I think, is definitely the way that the Trump campaign wants to go. And I think that's where Trump doesn't have to say what his specific plan is on Mosul. He can wait and then can pivot off of what happens. If it works well, he can say, great, we'll bank that and move on. If it works badly, he gets to position himself as the savior of the situation.
And yet at some point he's going to have to deal with ISIS.
Indeed.
Right. There are some tensions, let me put it that way, within Trump's thinking about ISIS. Because on the one hand, he has said that basically he'll destroy ISIS almost immediately and sort of take it seriously in a way that President Obama never did. But at the same time, he's also said there will be no nation building. Mm-hmm. That's another key pillar of his foreign policy, no nation building. So the question then is, well, what happens after ISIS is pushed out of Mosul, right? If we are just going to think of war in terms of bombing and destroying and not in terms of building and creating, then what happens when ISIS is pushed out? You have an incredibly tense situation in northern Iraq in which the Kurds, Shiite militia, government forces, Sunni groups are all going to be competing for the political control of Mosul. The Kurds, for example, have expanded their territory in the course of the fight against ISIS. Are they going to pull back? Mm. But my concern here is that Trump's vision of war is extremely narrow, and it's kind of kinetic and focused on explosives. And he's so averse to nation building when, frankly, there is going to need to be a great deal of nation building in Iraq and Syria. Now, just to be clear here, the United States doesn't need to dominate or even lead that effort, and I'm certainly not envisaging thousands of American ground troops. But the U.S. is certainly going to have to play a role in rebuilding and stabilizing Iraq and Syria.
Right. We've got some names that are floating to the top for Defense Secretary because Ash Carter is very unlikely to stay on
very unlikely.
As Defense Secretary. Senator Jeff Sessions, mm-hmm. Again, reading, hearing that he might indeed be Donald Trump's top pick. How does he shape that position?
Jeff Sessions probably, Don made an excellent point that there aren't a lot of people on the bench who line up completely with Donald Trump, but Jeff Sessions might be one of those mm-hmm. people. That Sessions, who is, he's positioned himself in the Senate as a very strong sort of immigration restrictionist, very strong nationalist, rhetorically similar to the kind of positions that Trump has taken. And so one could imagine him being more in line with Trump up and down the line on America First and whatever that means. I do think, though, what work I've done on the Department of Defense is it's very difficult for people, for outsiders to come in and effectively run the Pentagon because it's not just a policy position in the way that a national security advisor or even a secretary of state is. It's the largest bureaucracy in the government, if you count the uniformed services, and so as a result, you need somebody who's got administrative skill as well as policy chops. And I'm not sure that a senator is the right person for that.
Looking at President-elect Donald Trump, foreign policy, his picks for a number of positions, at least the consideration for these positions at this point. Our guests, Ron Granieri is Director of Research at the Lauder Institute, Dominic Tierney, Associate Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College. And again, the number is 888-477-9499. Stay with us. More just ahead. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, joined in studio this hour by Dominic Tierney, Associate Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College. He's a contributing writer at The Atlantic and Senior Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. And Ron Granieri is Director of Research at the Lauder Institute and Executive Director of FPRI's Center for the Study of America and the West. And we went into the break talking about Donald Trump's possible picks for defense secretary. How does the incoming defense secretary handle two initiatives of the Obama administration, one of which is integrating women into combat roles, and the other is allowing transgender people to serve openly? Mm-hmm. How do you see that playing out?
Right? I mean, there are a couple of possibilities, right? Trump, the new secretary can just leave the status quo and let things continue the way they have. It would be a big statement if the secretary were to get up and say, "Everything my I'm going to reverse some of the biggest things my predecessor did." But because these are not necessarily statutory decisions, they can be altered. And this is also where one of the big things that's going to continue within the DOD is differences among the services about how to deal with women in combat, for example. The role of the Marine Corps versus the Army versus the Navy, there are big questions. And the Secretary of Defense is the person who's supposed to referee those debates on behalf of the president. And so as a Secretary of Defense who was, say, more sympathetic to the positions of the Marine Corps might take different political positions if these things bubble up to the surface. But it seems unlikely to me that President Trump would rush to create a problem on this, but I think that divisions would very quickly become apparent if there is some political dispute or some controversy that emerges.
Yeah, Dominic?
Yeah, I mean, I essentially agree with that. I don't think this is going to be an issue in which Trump forces a dramatic change. Mm. There are many others that we have touched on, and I'm sure we'll touch on whether that's quite possible, but I don't think this is one of those issues. Trump himself... He's not a conservative ideologue on sort of social issues. He used to be a social liberal, and it's not clear where he really stands on some of these things. And I think on women in the military, my guess is that things will continue much as the Obama administration intended.
Okay, well, let's touch on Syria. Russia backs the Assad regime. The Obama administration has essentially said President Assad is responsible for atrocities, cannot remain in office. America supplies some military assistance to rebels, conducts airstrikes on ISIS. Considering what seems to be a cordial relationship at this point between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, how do you think U.S. policy towards Syria shapes up, Ron?
Well, I think that the Obama administration, while it has said what it would like to see happen in Syria, has also demonstrated very clearly the limits of what America is prepared to do. And it's the distinction between what we say we want and what we're prepared to do that's created a lot of the agita in the United States about Syria. I think that it is very likely that President Trump will resolve that contradiction in the sense of based on the relationship with Russia, but also based on wanting to make a statement about a contrast with the Obama administration, I could very easily see the United States simply announcing, or the Trump administration announcing, that there is no solution to Syria that does not include Russia, does not include Assad, and finding a rhetorical and practical way for the United States to let things take their course. And this is where I think the Russian offensive that has just started, Russian-led offensive that has just started in Aleppo, the new one, is an indication that the Russians would like to create a fait accompli for the Trump administration. And I think that the Trump administration would be very likely to grab that fait accompli, sadly, for the people of Syria.
We'll see. Go ahead, Dominic.
I would just add to that. Trump, I think, believes that the Assad regime is better than any likely alternative in Syria, and is comfortable with a key role for Russia and Assad staying in power. That is a direction, by the way, that the Obama administration itself was going. In other words, Obama had sort of come to realize that Assad was the lesser of two evils relative to ISIS, and there was an acceptance that he was going to stay in power, at least for a transitional period. Just one other policy that Trump has championed is this idea of safe zones in Syria. So Trump has repeatedly said that the U.S. could be involved in setting up safe zones, in part because this would help solve the immigration crisis and stop the flow of Syrian refugees. So you would create an area of Syria, and basically you would keep out aircraft, et cetera, and it would be a safe haven, a kind of ark for the Syrian people to go to. I do not believe that Donald Trump has thought through the consequences of what a safe zone policy would look like.
Who funds the safe zone?
Right. Who funds it? Who protects the safe zone? Most people in Syria have been killed by ground fire, by shells, by guns, not by aircraft. Mm-hmm. So you need ground troops. Who are those ground troops? Are they Americans? Are they Turks? Are they Kurds? Who are they? And unless you protect the safe zone, what you're going to have is a repeat of the Srebrenica massacre from, you probably remember from Bosnia, yeah, back in the 1990s. That was a safe zone, mm-hmm, protected by Dutch peacekeepers who essentially stood by, and Serbs massacred thousands of men and boys in Srebrenica. So the arc could become a trap unless this is very carefully thought through.
Mm-hmm. Now let's get to the phones. Jay in Fort Washington, welcome to Radio Times. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. So this has been a great discussion on foreign policy, but I wanted to pose a question to you and your guests. As the Jewish grandson of Holocaust survivors, I've watched with significant concern the appointment of Steve Bannon to a position of power in the White House, not an official position, but he's going to be very close to President Trump, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how that might influence domestic policy, and should I and others like me be worried?
All right, thank you, Jay, for the call. Stephen Bannon, Ron.
Should you be worried? I think it is very worrisome. I initially was a German historian, so this topic has been close to my mind. We talk about how do republics fall apart and what replaces them, and republics often fall apart when there are not enough Republicans. Democracies fail when there are not enough Democrats, right? When the population doesn't actually believe that the system deserves to be protected, and that means a lot of things, right? That means being willing to lose an election and not believe that it's Armageddon. It means being willing to win an election without feeling as though you have to crush your opponents. And all of those questions have been thrown up by the way that this campaign and its results have come. I think that Steve Bannon's brand of alt-right ideology should be a great concern to all Americans, should be a great concern to anybody who actually believes that a liberal society is worth protecting, liberal, small l. And I think that while I do think right now, at this moment on this day, I believe enough in the structures of the U.S. Constitution that, you know, this is not 1933, this is not Berlin. But I do think we need to be aware of the danger of allowing rhetorical excess to lead into political excess.
How long does he stay in the White House? Because you've got Bannon on the one side, and you have Reince Priebus, who was given the chief of staff's job.
Right.
A huge differentiation there. You have Paul Ryan. You have, to an extent, of course, Mitch McConnell. You've got Mike Pence, who is, you know, very conservative. But you've got a whole traditional way of doing things amongst the Republican Party and in Congress on one side. And that's a lot more than one person. And I'm just wondering, you know, and hearing now, of course, tension within the inner circle. You know, he's a nod to a certain movement within the United States, Bannon is. But how long does he last, do you think, Dominic?
So what Trump is doing is basically trying to balance out power between the various loyalist factions. And there weren't very many, right? Trump won the election. It was one man in an airplane, basically.
And a Twitter feed.
It's an astounding result against, you know, Hillary and Barack and Michelle and the entire infrastructure. And I think Trump would give his family positions if he could do, because he has this very kind of loyalist mentality. So it is possible that, you know, Bannon's time will be brief, that he upsets so many people that the establishment sort of finds a way to push him out, since the establishment knows how the game works better than Bannon does. But the question is, how much damage could Bannon do in a short amount of time, right? He's set his target sights on the global liberal order. Right, and this is absolutely critical. Since World War II, the United States has led an effort to create a liberal order around the world based on international institutions like the UN, the European Union, and so on, based on reduced barriers to trade. And this liberal order has been very successful overall, especially at preventing wars between countries, traditional wars. Hasn't stopped civil wars like Syria and so on, but that's hugely difficult, right? Mm-hmm. And Bannon sees this liberal order as being this globalist elite and basically wants to tear it down. And Trump seems sympathetic to that. So how much damage could he do is a critical issue. Yeah.
Well, all right, so let's go to Europe. You know, the election of Donald Trump has elated a number of far-right groups and leaders, and Marine Le Pen of France declared this a great movement across the world for one. Let's check, go to France for a moment. What does Marine Le Pen represent? Mm. And, you know, her group was considered to be a fringe group not so very long ago, and now she's talking about possibly winning the presidency in France next year.
Right. Well, the Front National has been building on its base in a particular kind of anti-immigrant sentiment in France that's been around for a long time. And they are being helped along now, going back to the, you know, how do republics fail, the massive unpopularity of the current president of France, the seemingly intractable economic and political malaise in France. The real questions about how to deal with immigration have opened the door for Marine Le Pen. She is much more telegenic and let's much more smooth in her choice of rhetoric than her father was, but her father still is the spiritus rector of that party, right? And her father is a man, Jean-Marie Le Pen's a man who has questioned the Holocaust, a man who has engaged in some of the worst forms of xenophobic rhetoric. It is a sign that there is no automatic defense for liberal society, right? That republics, liberal societies can only survive if the citizens of those societies believe in them enough to defend them at the ballot box, in the newspapers. I think that what we've seen with this election, and we can, and much more broadly, and this is what Europeans have felt since the Brexit vote, but even before, and that is there is, people might think, people in Philadelphia, people in New York, people in Cambridge, Massachusetts might think that there are no alternatives to the liberal world order that's been created since 1945. I happen to think it's a pretty good world order and it deserves to be protected. But that doesn't mean everybody thinks that. And if there are lots of people who simply want to blow it up or who have a specific alternative vision, the only way that liberal society survives, because liberal society is built around debate and discussion, the only way that it survives is if those people who think it's worth protecting are willing to engage in discussion about it.
Dominic Tierney, give us a sense of other similar groups in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Finland, which is generally a progressive society, who they are, whether they might make headways in upcoming
election. Well, I'll just pick up the example of Finland.
Yep.
This is a fascinating case, and what it shows is that Trumpism is a much wider phenomenon than just Trump, right?
All right, take a moment to define Trumpism in your words.
So we'll call it Trumpism, even though it predates Donald Trump, because he has come to sort of capture and characterize it so clearly. But it represents a sort of nationalistic attitude, mindset, and skepticism of immigrants is really at the heart of it. And so this has swept across much of Europe, swept across Britain with the Brexit decision. The center left and the left has no answer at the moment to this kind of populist nationalism. And the wave has even crashed in countries like Finland. So we think of Finland as, you know, for many left-wing people, it's the sort of one of the good guys, right? It's very socially welfarist country, extremely egalitarian, extremely highly educated, great healthcare system. Well, they have a party called the True Finns. 10 years ago or so, they were polling at about 1%. But they rode this wave of opposition to immigration to Finland, which is a very homogenous society, skepticism about the European Union. A couple of years ago, they entered the government. And the True Finns, the equivalent of the Trumpists, are in the Finnish government. Now, one lesson from Finland is that although populism seems very difficult to beat at the ballot box, is that once the populists get into power, they just don't know what to do.
Are we seeing that with the incoming Trump administration?
Right, exactly. So the True Finns had all of this rhetoric of we'll stop immigration. So once they were in government, they had no idea how to do it, and their popularity has crashed. With Brexit, right? As soon as the Brexiteers won the vote, they had no plan whatsoever for what was going to happen. And the same is true, I think, we'll see with Donald Trump, which is that this is a man who has no experience of government, facing a country that's incredibly divided, where the Democrats largely despise him, mm-hmm. as do many of the Republicans. His bench of loyalists, as we said, was extremely thin, and he's dealing with incredibly difficult domestic and international challenges.
So how does a Trump administration then deal with these changes in Europe, the advancement of far-right groups, if at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that certainly going back to the Steve Bannon question, right, the way that Trump will deal with that is by welcoming them as a great thing, right? Trump rushed to praise the Brexit vote in June, even though, amusingly, he did it after when he landed in Scotland, the one part of the UK that voted uniformly against Brexit. But that shows the depth of his research on the question. But this is where I think is potentially very this is something we're going to have to watch, is the degree to which the Trump administration would actually try to make common cause with other nationalist groups to weaken institutions like the EU and to then to pursue some kind of fragmented great power politics.
Dominic Tierney, the Finns, at least it's one particular party, are calling, leaving the European Union, what, fix it. So, I mean, how many of these groups are, across Europe, what are we seeing in terms of the movement to leave the European Union? And mm-hmm. might more Brexits become a reality over the next
quite possibly.
5-6 years?
The Italians might be next.
The Dutch.
Are probably a leading candidate. I don't think there's any exit going to happen immediately. A lot depends on the British experience, right? How painful is it for Britain mm-hmm. to leave? If it was a smooth exit and the British economy flourishes, then that's certainly going to potentially encourage other people to leave. And of course, what happens with the European Union? And does it get out of this economic malaise that it seems to have been stuck in mm-hmm. since the mid to late 2000s? We will see, but it's the risks are pretty significant.
All right, we're talking about the incoming Trump administration and the variety of situations around the world that awaits this administration. Our guest this hour, Dominic Tierney, Associate Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College, a contributing writer at The Atlantic, and Senior Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. And Ron Granieri is Director of Research at the Lauder Institute and Executive Director of FPRI Center for the Study of America and the West. And as always, we welcome your input to the conversation. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. Lots ahead. Like to pick up on the conversation and look at immigration in particular and the refugee crisis in Europe and how the Trump administration might address that right after the break. So keep it here for more of Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and in studio with us, Ron Granieri, Director of Research at the Lauder Institute. Dominic Tierney is Associate Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College. We're taking a look around the globe and talking about how the incoming Trump administration might handle a number of hotspots around the globe. I just want to talk about immigration for a moment. Obviously, an issue here on our borders and also in Europe. There's a lot of soul searching following this election about how things might have been done differently with any number of issues. And, let's just take a quick look, just for an example, in Europe. You've got millions of desperate people fleeing into Europe. How do nations provide for people, desperate people, employment and shelter, and at the same time absorb a new culture or cultures, while also providing for those who are already there so that the newcomers they're not perceived as a threat on a number of levels?
Yeah.
Brian?
I mean, this is it's both a practical and a philosophical question, right? It's a practical question of, where do you get the money? Where do you get the circumstances?
And can be applied abroad and at home.
Exactly. Yeah. And Angela Merkel in Germany, right, tried to deal with this largely as a practical issue by simply coming up with this phrase that she repeated over and over again, wir schaffen das, we can do it. That was her approach, that a rich country can do this. But it does leave open the bigger question of whether the entire society wants to do it. And this is where I think it gets very difficult, or becomes this symbolic issue as well as a practical one. Because to raise the money, to build the homes, to provide the shelter, to deliver the food, requires a society that's willing to spend, even when we're talking about just tiny percentages of the total population. But if people on a symbolic level see this as money that's being taken from one pot and put in another, and when they don't feel as though there's been a clear discussion about why this needs to be done, that creates then a political problem in a democratic society. And for a democratic government, once again, you can claim, I think correctly, that there is a moral responsibility and that it is doable. But you have to be able to convince people that this is so. And what we are seeing in Europe and what we are seeing with the election of Donald Trump in the United States is the political system has not been able to make this case effectively enough to the broader public. And in the face of pushback from the broader public, we have a lot of establishment politicians are essentially rolling over on this question.
Mm-hmm. All right. So Donald Trump wants to, closer to home, of course, Donald Trump wants to deport or jail, I think the figure is 3 million migrants, initially targeting those with criminal records. He's intent on building a wall with Mexico, portions of which might include fencing. This is the latest. And of course, Mexico says it's not paying for it. But Mexican President Enrique Nieto says his administration is willing to work with Mr. Trump. Mm-hmm. What's at stake here? How does this play out? Dominic Tierney?
Well, an enormous amount is at stake. For Mexico, of course, this is their critical bilateral relationship. It's a huge policy issue in the U.S. It's a huge human issue for millions of undocumented individuals in the United States. This figure of 3 million to be deported seems to have been plucked out of the air. Mm-hmm. These are supposedly the bad elements, the criminal elements. I don't know where this figure has come from. Paul Ryan said there won't be deportation teams, but that's what you would need if you're going to do this kind of systematic enforcement. You would need thousands of buses, tens of thousands of police or military, basically rounding people up. So my guess is that we're going to see some slippage in Trump's plan. The wall becomes a fence, and then it's not a fence that covers the entire border, and Mexico doesn't end up paying for the whole thing, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, Trump can do a lot as president on the immigration issue. This is an area in which the president has a significant amount of power and can make life very difficult for a lot of people in the immigration system. So even if we don't see the full extent of the wall, we could see a serious tightening. And as for the Syrian refugees, which you mentioned before, half the population of Syria are now either internal refugees or have fled the country entirely. The United States has a long history of taking in refugees, right? Huddled masses from around the world. This is part of the American story, the American experience. And yet there's no appetite for that at all, even to bring in a few thousand Syrian refugees when Germany has brought in hundreds of thousands, because of this fear that they will be a Trojan horse and one ISIS individual might slip through.
Well, Trump had said he would increase the vetting process. How would that change from what the Obama administration has already done?
There has to be some risk,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
When you bring in a few thousand refugees, it is possible that there's a few bad elements there, but this is the home of the brave, right? And in a sense, you accept a small, modest amount of risk in order to achieve a large humanitarian goal. And the bigger question here, I think, is whether these international issues are going to be dealt with in a multilateral way in which the United States shares the burden with other countries and negotiates broader solutions, or whether the vision really is every man for himself,
right,
every country for itself, and the U.S. just sort of reaches its own bargains.
Right. All right, hopscotching across the globe to Israel. Following the election, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called Donald Trump a true friend of Israel. And Shmuel Rosner is a senior fellow at the Jewish People Policy Institute. He writes in an op-ed in the New York Times, if all goes well, Israelis are going to love the Trump administration. Mr. Trump seems uninterested in pressuring Israel to give away land. He's promised to move the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And his view on the international agreement on Iran's nuclear program is as bleak as Israel's, and he vows to make it a priority to dismantle the disastrous deal with Iran. If his policies match his campaign rhetoric, Israelis with time will grow to like him. Is Rosner on target here?
Well, certainly some Israelis will grow to like all of those policies, but I think that there's a difference between the symbolic, heavily symbolic, but still very doable moving of the embassy and the United States withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. Because the United States can withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. That does not mean that the Europeans or the Russians are going to withdraw from that deal.
Well, that was my next question, deal. Too. Mm-hmm. I mean, can he walk back that deal? The UN Security Council has endorsed it as international law. Are mm-hmm. there not repercussions?
Well, certainly there would be repercussions on a very practical level. If the United States withdraws and says we're going to reimpose sanctions, we would be doing it on our own. There is no way the Europeans go along with that. There's no way the Russians go along with that.
I was going to say, Russia's involved, Vladimir Putin.
Right. And he's not interested in going back to when suddenly the bonanza of trade with Iran has opened up. None of these countries are going to go back on it. So this would be if the United States wanted to make this hugely symbolic and ultimately self-destructive and maybe even more largely destructive act, the United States could do that. The Trump administration could do that. I can't see anybody except for people who are simply wrapped up in abstract thoughts about the Iran nuclear deal who would think that would be just a great thing.
All right. Go ahead, Dominic.
So the Iran deal was negotiated not just by the United States, right, but by the P5 plus one, meaning the permanent five members of the Security Council plus Germany. So essentially the European Union and the Security Council sort of working as a team. And the nuclear deal is only controversial in the United States.
Right.
Right. So in Britain, it's not at all controversial. It's seen as a reasonable sort of compromise, not imperfect. Iran is, not a good guy necessarily, but a reasonable a negotiated settlement to a specific issue. It doesn't solve everything at all, but it helps to prevent Iran from developing the bomb. In the United States, it is controversial. And as Ron was saying, the president has significant discretion here, could simply reimpose sanctions. Mm-hmm. But the other countries are not going to go along with it. It's not clear what the effect of that would be. And do we really want to pull down the entire nuclear deal, even if we could? What will Iran do? Well, the centrifuges would start spinning again.
Exactly.
That is the first thing that's going to happen. And then we are facing this horrible choice that Obama tried so hard to avoid, the choice between allowing Iran to develop a nuclear weapon or capability or alternatively, war.
So if the U.S. walks out, though, the centrifuges start spinning again, or is the pact still strong?
They could, because it's unclear. If the United States pulls out of it, the other signatories could just say, well, then it may be a dead letter, but so are the sanctions a dead letter. So then we go back to the world without an Iran deal, without any sanctions, and that means everybody gets to do whatever they want. So the Iranians can trade with whomever they want, and they can build whoever they want.
Continuing with our telephone calls now, Emily in Pennsylvania, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
No problem.
My question was, I'm already alarmed at all of the different things that you've brought up this morning. So what exactly can we do to encourage this liberal government that we are all so proud of? What can we do to continue this? How can we get involved?
That's a good question. Ron?
Well, the best way to get involved is to be involved, right? To be aware, to be engaged in these discussions, to communicate with your representatives, to participate in politics at all levels, right? Remember, the largest single voting bloc on November 8th was Americans who chose not to vote. And so if we are serious about wanting to preserve the republic, then we need to remain active and we need to remain aware, right? We're not everything is not going to be perfect, but everything's also not necessarily going to be awful either. As long as we remain aware and we hold our representatives' feet to the fire, that to let them know that we are watching and we are and we have opinions.
All right, Emily, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Like to get to China. Regarding the trade value of goods and services between the U.S. and China, Dominic Tierney, I think I saw a figure of over $500 billion last year. And so the South China Sea, a critical shipping waterway, a number of things happening there. China's constructing artificial islands. You had the Navy ship that the warship that I think went through there last month, passing through waters claimed by China. So there's tension there. Donald Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail has been pretty harsh. Quote, in May, we can't allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing. And yet, Mr. Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping had what appeared to be a cordial conversation on Sunday. So, again, you've got this back and forth between the rhetoric and the moving forward with the Trump administration. But moving forward, again, how does the Trump administration parse this delicate situation with China?
So if you look at Trump's thinking, he on some issues, he's just all over the place. And, you know, strategy for ISIS and so on. But there are some common fundamental beliefs that he has. One is that he's very suspicious of American allies and doesn't think that they're doing enough. The second is he's very suspicious of international trade deals and thinks the United States always gets the short end of the stick. And also he's quite favorable towards autocrats. And these beliefs, which, by the way, he also believed in the 1980s. In 1987, he paid $100,000 to put an ad in the New York Times criticizing American allies. Used very similar language to what he uses today. Today, by the way, I don't think he would pay $100,000 to the New York Times to keep it afloat. But nevertheless, that's what he did in the 80s. So these are real core elements of his thinking. And applied to China, what we see is that he's not particularly concerned by the South China Sea issue or these sort of regional geopolitical battles. Instead, what you hear from Trump is America's allies should be stepping up, like South Korea in particular has really come in for criticism from Trump. It should be paying the U.S. for the troops, for example, that are in South Korea. What upsets Trump about China is trade. Mm-hmm. And supposed Chinese currency manipulation, failure to protect intellectual property, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, we've only got a few minutes left. I do want to get into the trade partnerships, the TTIP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. Do we expect a immediate action to dismantle, drastically alter these agreements? Yes.
Absolutely, with the Trans-Pacific issue. I mean, I think it's just debt. By the way, Hillary was also sort of drifting against it. But it's fascinating because that deal was in part supposed to be a way of balancing against China, right? Containing China. China was not part of the deal, right? So it was other sort of regional players. And yet it's interesting how that argument just never got much leverage, that this is a way of balancing China. It was purely in terms of, well, the American worker is going to suffer from this. He also talks about renegotiating NAFTA. That would be a huge effort. But definitely the Trans-Pacific issue is gone.
Yeah, he does. President-elect Trump or President Trump tell Chinese President Xi Jinping that the climate change is a Chinese hoax?
He doesn't even want to admit that he sent that tweet, right? When he was confronted with that tweet in a debate, he claimed, "I never said that."
But you have another huge international accord, the Paris Climate Change Accord, and a great deal of concern among countries that the U.S. will just walk away.
Right.
Easier said than done. I've read that it'll take several years to disengage.
It would take a while to disengage, but Trump could come out and just basically unsign the deal. Again, this is the sort of the weakness with Barack Obama's reliance on executive agreements. Mm-hmm. With the Republican Congress, Obama naturally turned to executive agreements as a way to get stuff done. Well, what you sign with a pen can be unsigned with a pen. Exactly. And if Trump wanted to do so, he could really do a great deal of damage to this very quickly.
Okay. Just a couple more quick picks for Trump administration positions. U.N. Ambassador, again, Kelly Ayotte is one of the names, a departing senator from New Hampshire. Richard Grenell, former spokesman for the United States ambassador to the United Nations. This position is second to Secretary of State. So very quickly, we've got 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it were somebody like Kelly Ayotte, this is somebody who is a figure of a relatively moderate conservative, would probably put a positive face on American engagement. Because this is the thing, right? So Americans can talk about wanting to check out of geopolitics, but geopolitics is like the Hotel California, right? You can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave.
And one more quick, I want to get a comment in here. Comment from Dale. What's done is done. Trump is our president. We have to deal with it. Dominic Tierney?
That is true. Absolutely. And people need to get on board, and we need to make this work.
All right, Dominic Tierney, thanks so much for joining us. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College, a contributing writer at The Atlantic, and a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And Ron Granieri, our thanks to you as well.
Thanks, Mary.
Ron Granieri is Director of Research at the Lauder Institute and Executive Director of FPRI Center for the Study of America and the West. And a reminder to visit our Facebook page and podcasts. Easy to get there. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for joining us for Radio Times.